You are listening to audio from Riverside Church. If you would like to check out more resources, please visit riverside.church. My name is Isla, if you don't know me, and I was quested to bring you the message today. But before we get started, I have a confession to make. So when Keith first reached out over email and was like, hey, are you interested in doing any of the end of Revelation messages, I misunderstood and I thought I was going to be speaking on Jesus coming in to conquer the earth as birds feasted on the flesh of kings. Like, pretty epic, right? I thought so. Anyway, I opened my email box and the Revelation passage that I was titled with was called The Bride. To be honest, my first reaction was, I got the girly message. Obviously, I'm a girl. I have nothing against that or anything girly. And really, the message today is more about the genius and love of God than it is about brides and human weddings. But as someone who grew up with a lot of brothers, you know, WrestleMania, skeet shooting, shoveling horse manure, I am much more comfortable talking about conquering kingdoms than about weddings. You know, these days when it comes to weddings, I feel a little more of a realist than a romantic. I still think weddings are beautiful. I still cry during weddings. They're an exciting new beginning. But we don't know how a marriage story will end. You know, being married is complicated. You know, deep down, I really want to be the hopeless romantic. But sharing life with another person means sharing in their suffering, whether that is mental or physical, whether it's with finances or childbearing or even tragedy. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm glad I got married. You know, if I woke up and was 20 again, I would jump on this magical mystery tour all over. But I can believe in the fairy tale ending more when it's in another world. When the suffering doesn't hit my friends, my family, then it's easier to believe that the hero will triumph, that love conquers all. So as I wrestled with my strange mixture of fairy tale, romance, and realism, I was really bothered by the cynic inside of me. So I started exploring what type of story is this thing that we call life. So I hope you'll join me today in discovering the reality of God's story. We're going to start at the beginning. So at the dawn of creation, there is beauty and peace. There's a joyful wedding that God orchestrates between Adam and Eve. But then a villain enters the story. And tragedy, pain, blame strike the happy couple. Later, God sends his son to redeem these broken people. He dies in tragedy, but he comes back to life in victory. Jesus then leaves this world to prepare a new home for his people. He tells us, spread his mission, do the king's work until he returns. So here we are. We're in 2021, and we find ourselves part of this great author's story. But what type of story are we part of? So when I taught English in high school, we focused on the four main literary types. And I'd show my students this handy wheel, and it shows romance, comedy, tragedy, and satire. And oftentimes, the key to placing a story within these groups is how the story ends. A famous Greek quote says, "Count no man happy until the end is known." The end of the story tells us what type of story it is. A tragedy ends in death. And this isn't the old age or the death of a celebrated hero or even the death of someone wicked. This is a death that could have been avoided. People missed the truth and it ended in tragedy. Romeo and Juliet is like this. It's the passion and pride within their families causes the teens to have an untimely death. The second death in Revelation is also a tragedy because people ignored the warnings. They ignored the cries throughout history. The good king has invited you to join this kingdom, but many still refuse. A satire ends with realizing a ridiculous or ironic reality of life. Satire is probably the world that I live in most days. It's the rolling your eyes realism. It's the irony of the moment when Jesus tells these clean, well-put-together Pharisees that they are filthy dirty on the inside, that they are whitewashed tombs. It's also the story of Don Quixote. He's a middle-aged man who loses his mind to insanity from staying awake all night scrolling through social media. Wait, sorry, that's not quite right. Actually, he stays up too late reading fantastical books about chivalrous knights. Then when he tries to become a hero in the real world, he rides a sickly, bony old horse, and he fights battles that don't exist, like windmills that he says are giants. He wants the honor of a knight, but he only makes himself into a fool. Now here's the big one. For any of you who love a good story, but you're like, ugh, when it comes to romance, I have a little surprise for you. See, we oftentimes think of romance as the mushy, gushy, fall in love story, but a true romance is a story that ends in victory. It is the hero's journey. So at the core, a romance is about a successful quest, overcoming an evil villain. When the hero slays the dragon, when the Avengers save Earth from aliens, again, that is a romance story. Now, of course, comedies are usually silly and lighthearted, but in the world of Shakespeare and classic literature, comedies typically end in a marriage. When the evil, ridiculous stepsisters, when they can't fit their big feet into the tiny glass slipper, and then Cinderella ends up marrying the prince, that is a comedy. And it's a comedy because it's Cinderella overcoming the things of society to marry the prince, to find true love, to gain a home for herself. You know, most people have heard about Dante's Inferno, which is the allegorical trip to hell where people are punished based on their specific sins. But the full work is called the Divine Comedy. The story ends with the marriage, with Dante being joined with God and the saints in the heavenly domain. So, of course, a good story intertwines all of these elements, but the ending is what truly defines it. So let's recap quickly. Tragedy ends in death. Satire ends in exposing reality. Romance ends in victory. And comedy ends in marriage. So my first point today is that the greatest story ever told, penned by the genius of all creation, is indeed a romantic comedy. The best reality ends with King Jesus claiming his kingdom in victory and marrying his bride. So if we want to be like Jesus, let's try to put aside our current sarcasm and our tragedy just for a moment and enjoy the grand finale of God's romantic comedy. At this point, you can join with me in turning to Revelation 21, verse 9. Revelation 21, verse 9. We're going to be reading from the NLT version this morning. Oh, okay. So at this point, Jesus has conquered all of creation. We have a new heaven and a new earth. The wars are over. The struggle is over. The judgment is complete. Everyone is gathered for the wedding and waiting in expectation. The groom enters the room. Everyone looks at the excited man waiting for his bride to be revealed. So imagine Jesus as we have seen him in Revelation, with a crown on his head and a scepter in his nail-scarred hand. His throne is secure forever. He is the King of Kings. The earth belongs to him. Now, when God's own son celebrates his bride, reveals his royal city, is there a limit he can afford? Are there resources that are beyond his reach? No, no way. He will spare no expense. This is wedding day. So the music plays, the doors swing wide open, everyone stands and holds their breath as the organ pumps out, dun, 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 dun. So verse 9. Then one of the seven angels who held the seven bowls containing the seven last plagues came and said to me, "Come with me, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." So he took me in the spirit to a great high mountain, and he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. The angel invites John to see the bride coming down the aisle and walking onto a new earth. As Benji pointed out last week, this is when heaven and earth join together and become one, where God and his people are joined together forever. But before the bride comes fully into view, John first sees the groomsmen coming forward. These are the honored friends, the firsthand witnesses of the groom who support this union. So in verse 11, it says, "It, the city, shone with the glory of God and sparkled like precious stone, like jasper as clear as crystal. The city wall was broad and high, with 12 gates guarded by 12 angels, and the names of the 12 tribes of Israel were written on the gates. There were 3 gates on each side, east, north, south, and west. The wall of the city had 12 foundation stones, and on them were written the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb." So here's the first description of the glorious city. It is sparkling and shining with the glory of God. I thought it was important to try to visualize what we're seeing here. I'm no artist, so please bear with my word art shapes so we can get a rough layout of the wall and the gates of the city. So as you can see, we've got the 12 pearly gates. Each gate is inscribed with the name of one of the 12 tribes of Israel. And each foundation stone is inscribed with one of the names of the 12 apostles. Now, the exact names are not listed here, and there's a little debate on what names are included or excluded. So if you want to chase that wild goose, let me know if you catch it. In any case, I find it interesting that the apostles are the foundation stones because Jesus gave a very personal message to Peter. He said to him in Matthew 16, "Now I say to you that you are Peter," which means rock, "and upon this rock I will build my church, and all the powers of hell will not conquer it." So in the New Testament, the church is often called the bride of Christ, and in Revelation 21, it says the bride is called the city of Jerusalem. So I always thought Peter being the rock that the church is built upon was more metaphorical. But here, it seems to have a literal representation. The city is literally built on the rocks or foundation stones of the 12 apostles chosen by Jesus in the New Testament. And then when we enter into the city, we enter through gates that are inscribed with the name of the 12 tribes of Israel from the Old Testament. So just as the honored groomsmen and bridesmaids in a wedding are listed in the ceremony, they're given special name tags, special seats. The 12 tribes and the 12 apostles are honored forever in the city of God. Now we're going to move in closer. We're going to get a few more details on this bride, the city of the New Jerusalem. Verse 15, "The angel who talked to me held in his hand a gold measuring stick to measure the city, its gates, and its wall. When he measured it, he found it was a square as wide as it was long. In fact, its length and width and height were each 1,400 miles. Then he measured the walls and found them to be 216 feet thick, according to the human standard used by the angel." Now, it's really, really easy to kind of gloss over this and move on, But we have to look at this math to understand how wildly amazing the structure is. Okay, first we're going to get the shape correct. So the city is a square, or a cube, to be more precise. The length, width, and height are all the same. By American NLT measurements, it's 1,400 miles in every direction. So to create a tangible comparison, I found this handy map online that allows you to draw out distances between places. So most of us are familiar with road trips in the US, so we're just going to measure it right here in the United States so we can reference the size and scale of this magnificent city. But first we're going to do from top to bottom, north to south. So if one travels smack dab in the middle of the US, you would go from the border of Canada to Mexico to get 1,400 miles. So the New Jerusalem, the city from north to south, would reach from Canada to Mexico. And now we need to look at it east to west. For fun, we're going to start in South Bend. We'll take a road trip across the good old Midwest. About the time we hit the Utah and Nevada border, we have traveled 1,400 miles. So the city spans roughly from our borders of Canada to Mexico, then from South Bend to the border of Nevada. Okay, now we need to make this an actual square. And if you remember from school, the way to find a perimeter around a fence or walls, you need to add all four sides together, or you take the measurement of one side and multiply it by four. So our total perimeter equals 5,600 miles squared. Now, my online map was giving me fits to make this exact, but this is the best matchup I could get. So remember, this is the city. This is not the new earth. This is just the city of God that comes down from heaven. And before we move on, I do need to send a few condolences out for all of you Michigan and Ohio fans. I'm really sorry, but apparently your teams didn't make it into the city. The Golden Dome is safely secure within the walls. So we have the perimeter roughly mapped out, but there's one more dimension we need to look at. The height of the city is also 1,400 miles. Now, from the Tower of Babel till now, every country seems to be in competition who can make the biggest, best, the tallest building. At the moment, the tallest structure on Earth is Burj Khalifa in Dubai, which comes in at 2,716 feet. So the tallest building in the world is about half a mile up, which is nowhere near 1,400 miles high. We're going to go a little further. Planes fly around 6.6 miles high. Space begins at 62 miles up. The space station is 220 miles above the ground. Now, the city of God is far from the distance of our moon, but as you can see, we are in a new creation. We are in a new dimension where the city can literally reach up into the heavens and into what now we call space. So massive, giant, colossal, don't even begin to describe the New Jerusalem. Now, there's one more thing worth noting here. Remember how we mentioned the shape is a cube, right? So it seems worth noting that in the Old Testament, the Holy of Holies, the dwelling place of God's presence, was also the shape of a cube. In 1 Kings 6, it says that King Solomon prepared the inner sanctuary at the far end of the temple where the Ark of the Lord's Covenant would be placed. This inner sanctuary was 30 feet long, 30 feet wide, and 30 feet high. He overlaid the inside with solid gold. So God's dwelling place with the children of Israel in the Temple of Jerusalem was a gold-plated cube. And the New Jerusalem, where God will dwell with his people, is also a golden cube. I have no idea why God prefers cubes. We tend to show him as a triangle with the Trinity, but in any case, it shows that he is a detailed creator. He was with us in our history. He is with us in the present, and he is taking great care in preparing our future together. Our God spares no detail, and he spares no expense. He is the master architect, the artist, the carpenter, the mathematician, the poet. And we aren't even finished looking at the city. So let's continue. So we're moving now from math and scale to geology. Verse 18 says, "The wall was made of jasper, and the city was pure gold, as clear as glass." I think most of us can visualize a city of gold, right? It's brilliant and bright. It's like the sun. But jasper is a little trickier for us to picture. The best way to describe it is a rich, colorful stone, more exotic than granite and marble. It's found in a variety of colors, but John doesn't tell us what the precise color is. The jasper could be a red-brown variety, like the red of the lamb's blood on the doorframe. It could be green, the color of new life sprouting from the ground in the springtime. I did find two stunning pictures of larger chunks of jasper in nature that can kind of further feed our imaginations about the beauty of the city walls. So in Jasper National Park, there is this blue and golden wall of an ice cave, which would be a stunning wall around a golden city, like the glory of the blue sky with sunbeams coming down through it. Or in Oregon, there is this kaleidoscope jasper, and it's almost like a rainbow of rock. So if you can imagine, the God who created the rainbow in the sky might just put a wall of rainbow around his golden city. Now we're going to look at the details of the foundation stones. So if you remember a few verses ago, the foundation stones are engraved each with the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And if there are any geologists listening, try not to throw stones if I mess up these rock-hard names. Verse 19, "The wall of the city was built on foundation stones, inlaid with 12 precious stones. The first was jasper, the second sapphire, the third agate, the fourth emerald, the fifth onyx, the sixth carnelian, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, the 11th jacinth, the 12th amethyst." So each of these foundation stones are decorated with their own gems. And it's not random. Every apostle has their own specific stone that represents them. So just as the Holy of Holies was a cube and the New Jerusalem is a cube, there seems to be a connection between the 12 disciples and the 12 tribes of Israel. You see, the priests in the Old Testament, they had this chest piece that they would wear when they were seeking God's direction for the people. It was a golden square, and it held a different gemstone representing each tribe, and it also had their names engraved on it. Isn't that wild? So some of these stones literally seem to be exactly the same in Exodus 28 as in Revelation 21. So if you want to, you know, muddle through different translations and follow that rabbit hole, let me know if you find anything. On another note, if you feel a little left out, like you need a stone with your name engraved on it, go back to Revelation chapter 2, where Jesus says the one who is victorious will get their own white stone with a new name written on it. All right, we have one verse of geology left. If you remember earlier, the gates are guarded by 12 angels, and each gate has one of the 12 tribes written on it. So here is the next wow detail that John gives us. Verse 21. "The 12 gates were made of pearls, each gate from a single pearl, and the main street was pure gold, as clear as glass." So these gates aren't just made of a combination of pearls. They are made of one single pearl. To illustrate this, the biggest single pearl to be found on earth was found by a fisherman in the Philippines inside a giant clam. It is about 2 foot long, 1 foot wide, and weighs 75 pounds. But for a pearl to be the size of a typical, at least 8 foot human door, we would need to find something 4 times longer than what we've found so far. And as far as the main street being pure gold, I just have a quick side comment. So it is said that Caesar Augustus claimed that he came to Rome and he turned it from stone into marble. Well, Caesar, one day when our king comes to town, he's going to turn our crumbly, pothole, asphalt streets into pure, smooth gold. All right, we've taken the measurements. We've looked at the beautiful gemstones. We've imagined the streets of gold. Now we have the final descriptions here in Revelation chapter 21. Before we read it, I want you to remember when Jesus was born. Both in Isaiah and in Matthew, it says that people who were in darkness saw a great light. And then I want to go back even further to Genesis 1:3, where the very first words spoken in the Bible are, "Let there be light." Let's continue reading in verse 22. "I saw no temple in the city, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. And the city has no need of sun or moon, for the glory of God illuminates the city, and the Lamb is its light. The nations will walk in its light, and the kings of the world will enter the city in all their glory. Its gates will never be closed at the end of the day, because there is no night there. And all the nations will bring their glory and honor into the city. Nothing evil will be allowed to enter, nor anyone who practices shameful idolatry and dishonesty, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life." So our section today began by noting the 12 tribes and the 12 apostles have their names written on the stones and gates of the city. And it ends by saying, we can enter the city if our names are found and written in the Lamb's Book of Life. So people who follow other gods, who follow the things of this world, or who live a lie, thinking that they can create paradise without the Creator, they will not be allowed to enter the city of light. In Ephesians 5, it says that we were once children of darkness. But now, right now, we are the children of light. So this reality is not just for the future of a world of endless light and a beautiful city. Right now, we belong to the city of God. Right now, we are invited to be victorious heroes in God's story. We walk in this world as royal citizens of the most spectacular kingdom ever created. So we can deal with the troubles of this world. We can deal with the satire and the tragedy because we have the light within us and we know the end of the story. So what a privilege it is that God shares his story with us and invites us into it. Though life is often full of the eye-rolling ridiculousness or the heartbreaking tragedy, for believers, we have great hope. Our story ends in victory and comedy. Darkness and death are defeated. The innocence and the goodness of creation is restored. The author and finisher of our faith not only gives us a hero's ending, but also a new home filled with beauty and love. No city has ever been built like God's city. No wedding has ever been filled with as much glory and wealth and joy as the wedding between Christ and his people. No groom has chosen to suffer with his bride like Jesus did. So as Keith and Benji come back up to get ready to lead us in songs of praise to our God, let's remember that we are to walk in this world right now filled with that blazing light of our King. We cannot enter the story yet, or the city yet. We're part of the story, but we can't make it to the end yet. But we belong to that city. The wedding date has not arrived, but we can RSVP and we can get our names written in the Lamb's Book of Life. We are invited right now to live in God's story. It's a romance about a good king who sacrifices himself to rescue his people from a prison of darkness. He will cast out the dragon. He will claim his rightful throne on earth. We also live in a happy comedy where the gracious king builds a beautiful palace and a beautiful city for his bride. So if we can just give up our grip on this dark world that we've always known, we can live with him in a new world of light. Our story ends in triumph and celebration. It ends with light and life. And as a romantic comedy, it really ends as we deeply long for every story to end with a new beginning. The good, triumphant Creator King and his bride, the church, live happily ever after together in the spectacular city of God. Let's pray. God, I thank you for your story. Even speaking those words, sometimes it can feel too good to be true. It can feel like it is for another person or another people. But God, I pray that the reality of your story, the reality of your work in this world, will just take deep root in our hearts, and that we may know you for your goodness. We will know you as the victorious one, God, and that we will ever stay on this journey and in a part of your story, God. In the name of Jesus, amen. Thank you for listening to Riverside Church. For more resources, visit riverside.church.